I haven't got a huge agenda here. I'm not exactly sure what's going to come of this because I'm actually expecting more of a conversation. You have two mics? Two mics is one. Two mics is good. Okay. So the idea would be more of a conversation around this topic of something like spirituality and the environment, or Buddhism and the environment. And just by way of trying, as by way of an introduction, just a little bit about myself and what's got me to this place. So in my early years, I actually spent a lot of time meditating. And like a lot of people, particularly those that weren't brought up in a Buddhist tradition, it came from a place more of personal suffering. So mindfulness and meditation practice was a refuge for me, and work was less important. I had some flexibility, thankfully, with regards to work, so I could spend a lot of time actually on retreat. And over a period of time, so it's either that I'd be on retreat or I'd be at a centre or I'd be working at a centre, and my life was really focused around the Dharma at that point of time. And over a number of years, you know, work took on more of a priority. There was more to do with the family. And over time, there was an engagement, especially in the last 10 years, with environmental issues. And the reason that arose was probably a deep felt understanding that this was just so fundamental, the things that were going on in relation to climate change that posed such an existential threat. That we needed to do something about it. It was really important that everyone needed to do something about it, and particularly the health sector. Because from where I stood and where groups of us stood, we began to understand that really the priorities around health were a healthy environment. Without a healthy environment, we had nothing. Clean air, clean water, shelter, a stable climate and environment were just fundamental to human health. So I could see that as part and parcel of my work as a doctor, but there would be this split between life doing retreat, which was really calm, where it was conducive to where you felt protected and safe, and where that clarity of mind unfolded a certain understanding, and then stepping out into this world of environmental advocacy. For anyone that's actually been in that space of environmental advocacy, it's driven a lot by fear and anger, okay? People that are in that space care deeply. They care deeply for this thing, the environment, and it hurts them. And out of that hurt, they rebel and fight back, right? And what motivates them is sort of an anger at seeing what's actually happening in the world. And if you actually look at tactics that are actually used in the environmental movement, anger is one of them. So to motivate people, campaigns around making people angry, that they take action. They take action for the things that are going on, and that's what motivates them. If you look closely at activists, then what you see is a lot of burnt out activists because you can only stay angry for so long before it actually destroys you. It's fundamentally really unwholesome, a really unwholesome space to be in. So there was this weird sort of contradiction in my life. There'd be one aspect of it that'd be around a fostering of calm and peace and clarity, and then they'd be stepping into this space that I thought needed to be stepped into, that we needed to step into this space because the very thing that supported us, this world, was under threat. But to engage in that was really unsettling, was really disturbing, remains really disturbing because it brings up a whole heap of very difficult emotions. And so the query to me was then, how did I reconcile these two bits of my life? Because I could do this flip-flop where I'd go straight into one and then jump into the other and then jump back to this one, jump into the other. What would be a resolution that brought these two things together? What would bring spirituality and this advocacy space find a way that they could actually be brought together and made whole rather than two different things? So that's my interest. That's the thing I want to talk about. That's the one thing I want to have a conversation about. And it is definitely a conversation because I don't pretend to have all the answers. And along the way, the thinking would be, how would Buddhism and its practices inform environmentalism and the advocacy? What can we learn from Buddhism? What, you know, there's some great tools within a meditation tradition that seem really important. So what is there within Buddhism that could inform the environmental movement? How should Buddhists engage? You know, there's traditionally, we don't engage traditionally. You know, we step aside from this and we focus on practice, right? But here we have something that threatens our very existence, threatens the world's very existence. So how should Buddhists at this time actually engage in this issue? And the other thing, which is the flip side, and perhaps as important, what does the environmental movement have to say to Buddhism that they can actually learn from? You know, that's a funny idea, but what is it that the environmental movement, what can it say, what does it offer that we can understand something about our own practice? Because in this issue about climate change is probably, you know, the biggest existential issue that's actually facing humanity, right? And Buddhists are good at existential. You know, we're really good at impermanence, death, no self. We're really good at that, but here it is. It's coming at it from a different perspective here. It's coming in from it from an environmental perspective. So how does it inform what we're doing in terms of a traditional practice? So that's some of my thinking. In terms of trying to maybe define some parameters about where the discussion could go, would be something that's on my mind would be, what do we mean by being Buddhist? Because there are lots of different schools of Buddhism, and I've moved through a number of different schools in different ways. So we'd have to have come up with some definition that it was beyond the different practices, because there are lots of different practices. You go to different traditions and they're fundamentally different. Zen Buddhism looks really different to Tibetan Buddhism. That looks very different when you go to a Theravadan Thai monastery. So I would say, if we could say that we all agreed that there's no inherent self, or there's no inherent entity that's not sort of compounded, that's like part of the four seals, there's no inherent self, that all things are impermanent, that there is something that's fundamental that's talked about, that's suffering, and that could be said that there's a level of uncertainty in our living. There's a constant uncertainty in our life, and based on that uncertainty, we grasp to make something certain when we can't, which forever brings uncomfortable emotions. So I would say at least those three, and maybe some idea that, inverted commas, nirvana is beyond concept, that there's some level of understanding that's really difficult to talk about, that's very difficult to talk about, that's beyond concept. So if that's the ground that we're talking about, and going, well, then when I say, how does environmentalism inform these ideas? And I would say there's a lot in the environmental movement that can inform some of these ideas and maybe shape a different way that we can approach these topics that are so important within Buddhism. So I was hoping for questions, you know, I was hoping for questions. And just because I knew that people were going to be really reluctant to ask questions, I asked for people to send some questions, and I'm really disappointed because you guys only came up, there's only like two people that came up, and I'm sure people got more questions. So maybe we should just to get it going, there were two people, who were the two? Can someone ask one of the questions? There was an Indu. Is Indu here at all? Or she piped out?
Overseas, because we said that it's not live stream, but they can give their questions in, so they might not be from here.
Oh, this is going to be really interesting. okay, and there was another one, that's Chris. I don't know if Chris is here. Is Chris here? There's no. There's no Chris either. This is really interesting. I get two questions from people that aren't here. Okay. I will then at least ask their question, first of all, that we can get started. One's a lot easier to ask than the other, but both of them are pretty tough. So one of the questions was around the problem with trying to deal... Oh, it was a Craig. Sorry. Let me see whether I would take Craig or whether I do Indu. Let me just think. I'll start off with Indu because maybe it's easier. Chris, mind you, both of them are really difficult questions. So the question was around neoliberalism, and based with neoliberalism being so prominent in the world, how could we ever deal with it? Because it seemed to be the thing that was stopping action on climate change. Does anyone know what neoliberalism is? Is anyone familiar? No one's familiar. One, two. Anyone else? So a brief little idea around neoliberalism, okay? This is not an economic theory. I'm not an economist, but I can give you the rough feel of how people are thinking about this topic. So there's an idea about the free market. And the idea about the free market and economy is that the best thing you could possibly do for the world is just let the market, leave the market alone, give it as much freedom as possible, because when wealth is generated through a free market, all will be well. Wealth will flow through to all sorts of people from top down, if it is that lots of people earn money, and people will be better for it, right? So that's an idea. And the idea around creating a free market is you completely try to deregulate it. The less regulation, the better. The less government control of entities, the better. And there's a whole notion around deregulation that will allow the market to operate the best that it can, the best that it can. So that's an idea behind neoliberalism, that what's going to drive progress is freeing up the market. And there's some validity to it, okay? There is some validity to the fact that a market is important to my mind. And behind that is a little, this idea of freedom is a really interesting thing because it links in with an idea, it gets conflated with the idea that people should be free to do what they like, right? So behind it is also an idea built into the economics, is a notion that people should be free to do what they like, and when everything is deregulated, there's less tax, there's an even playing field on tax, then everyone has a chance to progress. So the people that are unhappy about neoliberalism, that counter it, that say that what happens, because their concern is this. What neoliberalism doesn't take into account then, and the freedom that it offers means, it seems that it means that it's free to pollute the hell out of the world. That it's free to exploit people and pay them as little money as possible. It's free to remove the rights of unions to try to establish a fair wage. It implies that everything is fair when everyone knows that those that are really wealthy, based on their inheritance, based on the fact they have money to be educated, will always do better because they've already got an advantage. And those that are poor, that don't have the education and don't have the capacity, really don't have that chance to actually progress. So as much as it's espoused as an idea, you can sort of pick holes into this. And the notion is that the world is heading this way towards this neoliberal agenda where everything's just about money and progress. And I would say that that agenda is amongst us. You know, this idea of being so solely focused on the economy is definitely part of what's going on in the world. I mean, it's amazing. The stock exchange comes up at the news. You know, when I grew up, the stock exchange on the news would be as boring as batshit, really, seriously. And all of a sudden now, we're seeing this thing in the news, and I'm going, what's going on? There's some other issues, aren't there, other than economics? So There's a discourse that's going on that's also very focused about self. So within neoliberalism is the idea of yourself and progressing yourself. And there's little idea around values, about what is reasonable, about what is fair, what is just, what is it that we need to do to care for others. So the question then really is, the fact that this becomes such a dominant idea and seems to stop any progress on climate change because everyone just wants progress, and progress means more consumption, chewing up energy, chewing up things in a world that has limited resources, how can it possibly be that we can do anything about climate change? So that was the question being posed. And what is it that we're going to do about it is the other bit that's probably being asked. So as I said, it's just a wee little question that is being posed. And if anyone that's got some really good answers, I'd be really happy to hear them around what we need to do. There's a couple of points I would like to try to just pull through and use a sort of Buddhist framework. You know, in Buddhism, everything starts from right view. And then it moves on to right intent, and then from there, a set of actions based on a clarity of perspective about what the world really is or what reality really is. And then founded on that, a clear intent, acting on what is true, right? So for me, that's the first step. So what is right view in this context? And this is my perspective coming from an environmental perspective. The environmental perspective, for my sake, is that we don't live independent of everyone else. You know, all of us live in this one world, and we're completely dependent on this one world. And I get haunted by a little image of a planet in space, Earth in space, and me above it, where I can see the details of this world and understand. I can see the clouds and I can see the lights of the city at nighttime, and I can see the forest because I'm just quite close enough to be able to see all that. And I understand that this is the only place where life exists as far as we know it in the universe. And this is the only thing we have, right? So us 7.8 billion people, all the animals, all the trees, all the life that exist, we're in this thing together, and we completely coexist with nature. We're completely dependent on it in every possible way, from the air that we breathe, so that right now you're breathing oxygen from the Amazon right now, produces about 20% of the world's oxygen. You're completely dependent on the rain that comes, which comes from all sorts of different ways that ends up being from lakes and rivers and evaporation that then comes and over the mountains and the rainfall. So we're completely dependent on the environment for our well-being. I'm completely dependent on the food from the farmer, right? We can see it as a transaction where I buy my food, but really I'm gifted by the food of the farmer. I'm gifted by the fact that that the rain comes that can actually nourish the crops. I'm gifted by the sun, right? That's necessary for the food to grow. So I'm dependent on the farmer. I'm dependent on the person that's working on the factory floor somewhere in India making this shirt. So everything is interdependent. And we live in this one world. So if that's right view, or at least comes closer to right view, and speaks of our interdependence, or you could say the compounded nature of our reality, that there really isn't a separation from me and them and the world, that should shape how I act. That should shape how I think. That should shape what I purchase in the shop. You know, that should shape what I do in my waste if I understand that this doesn't go anywhere other than back into this planet that I'm living in. You know. And that there should be a respect then for all the things that actually support me. So with that in mind, I have a different view, I think, of being in the world. So that's one idea. So if you're going to break down, if you're trying to break down neoliberalism, one idea would to see the interconnected nature of how we are. The other aspect about neoliberalism then is this whole focus on self. So what's the antidote to focusing on self? I think the antidote is focusing on other people. I think the antidote is focusing on our relationships. You know, the things that bind us. The things rather than seeing isolated is actually in the context of the communities that we build, how we can reach out to other people and build that sense of connectedness and cross silos that we can actually meet with people that we don't normally meet with and break down these barriers that actually stop us from actually connecting. And it really marries for me as a health practitioner that's interested in mental health, is that one of the most despairing things currently relates to this rate of depression and mental illness that's in the community. And if you look at where it arises from and some of the sources, then part of it is just simply that people are lonely and disconnected. They're disconnected from each other. They're disconnected from the environment. They're disconnected from meaningful work. They're disconnected from values that lead to a meaningful life. So we need to build back these sense of connections to meaning, to meaningful communities, to meaningful values. So connecting is worthwhile. You know, building communities is worthwhile. It's worthwhile, I think, thinking about, because climate change is such, makes you feel so isolated, is actually connecting with others that are engaged in the climate movement. And we have people here, in terms of there are Buddhists for the Environment here, for example. That's a group that's doing this. So meeting with other people so that you're not alone in that attempt to meet with other people and actually build a sense of community taking action. I think those things are really important. And then we really seriously as a community need to start talking about values. Because the thing that's strong within a neoliberal agenda is it's completely valueless other than the freedom to do what I like. You know, this notion that I'm free to do whatever I like, irrespective of anyone else, and it's all about money. So we need another discourse. Is this the world I want to live in that's purely focused on GDP as a measure of progress? Or am I going to be interested in a world that actually espouses a different set of values, where kindness is valued, where relationships are valued, where the health is valued, where a sense of community is valued? So we need to start having a discourse about what a meaningful world is, what a meaningful society is beyond GDP. And people are doing that. So we're having different measures of, people are coming up with different measures of progress other than GDP. GDP is such a weird thing, you know. If you have a bushfire like the Black Saturday bushfires where 173 people were killed or something like that, and countless properties were destroyed, and you lost something like $4 billion worth of property and a whole number of things, intangibles, cost about $4 billion. That's counted as a plus on GDP because you actually have to put that money back in again. And so in terms of economic scale, it comes out as a plus. And so in terms of GDP and how we're going, it looks like it's really good. I'm going, that's really perverse. That is such a perverse measure of progress. We surely could come up with a better measure of progress. So the discourses, I think, are important, and I think we need to start speaking up about what it is that we want in terms of society. What are our values? And, you know, if there's one people that can talk about values and make a stance, it surely is the spiritual religious community. That's we as a community need to take a stand on some of these issues and speak from the values that where we come from, that it can be heard in our communities. Otherwise, it's no one speaking it. So who should be speaking it other than spiritual and religious communities? So we need to hear that, especially in the context of climate change. We should be hearing much more of that. So as I say, it was a really little question. It's got a slightly big answer to it. Does anyone want to respond to it? Because I'm really, I don't want to just be talking. Anyone got any comments? Yep.
Thank you, Richard, for coming and, you know, for speaking about such an important issue that we all feel so passionate about. There is a beautiful Buddhist Lama teacher, spiritual leader that's over from Bhutan, yeah. And she runs beautiful programs for blessing the climate. And tomorrow there's a 2-hour sacred flag, peace flag blessing for the earth,
yes,
in Yanship at from 2 to 4 at 11 Brazier Way. And she does other things, but last weekend we did one on death and dying, and part of it was to honour all the sea creatures and the animals as well, and we released live marin into the local spring there, or to the local swamp.
Yeah.
And you know, it's that's how we can, you know, help, by actually sending blessings and being involved in people that are, you know, that can do these wonderful things, not just fighting for against, you know, sort of the problems, but actually blessing and supporting one another and supporting the earth. She will, I think, the following weekend be doing a beautiful flower mandala in Fremantle. And I just feel very grateful that I can feel the love through these ceremonies, the Buddhist ceremonies. And the other thing that I was very inspired by was the movie 2020. Are you familiar with that movie?
No, don't know that one.
The producer was the one that did the Sugar movie, and he was so worried about the future of climate change for his daughter, his young daughter, that he decided to make a movie on it, and he travelled the world, and he basically went to all the ecosystems, the sustainable ecosystems throughout the world, the planet, and put them all together. And it was so incredibly inspiring and hopeful and joyful, and it showed you that there are so many positive things happening in the world to give hope, to give inspiration, like on the just sustainable farming, eco-farming, and the, you know, just different countries like Pakistan, where they have incredible systems for electricity, things like that. It showed you that there are people that are, you know, able to put these things together and make and help the planet. So, yeah, but I just like to encourage people to seek movies like that, and to seek people like Chandra Rinpoche. She's the Buddhist Lama that's over, and she's doing ceremonies here.
So,
and
I think there, I mean, to respond to that, I think there's really important things to actually note all the positive things that are being done, and
yes,
to tell
exactly
the positive story about what is possible.
Yeah, to give
and
us
it's
hope.
Really, really impossible. It's really, really important. But there's lots of. It's a broad issue. The other issue is the fact that there are things that are being done that are destructive, right now. There are things that are happening that are destructive, and while there are good things happening, there are steps that need to be taken to stop the destruction. There's steps that need to be taken that we actually make some attempt to stop that from happening in the most peaceful way as possible, with the most heartfelt way as possible. And I think it requires action from all fronts, and not just from one side in terms of the progressive things that are being done. And we need to keep all those things in play, from the personal to the very large things that are actually happening.
I agree, but it's very important that we have inspiration and hope.
Sure. Was there? Yep.
Thank you for addressing us. I'm Craig. I sent you that.
Thanks. You're going to get it knocked off in a nutshell. Right?
I'm not even going to try. But I just want to make a couple of points. Firstly, Anusha's quote from Facebook, I agree with a great deal of. I disagree that scientists are not capable of understanding that this is potentially a spiritual problem.
Yeah.
They are. And there are people like me, quite a few, yeah, who understand that. What troubles me about that is it seems like the community is asking of science that it illuminate the problem, it identify the problem, illuminate, detail the problem, suggest solutions, and then implement them.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be a bit rough. I mean, what's everybody else doing? And granted, scientists aren't great at expressing themselves emotionally. If they were, we'd be in trouble. But and the second point I want to make is I just want to reassure everybody that we've got nothing to worry about with regards to the planet.
The planet will look after itself.
The planet is fine. It's been through this process. There's been 5 major extinction events on the planet.
Yeah.
There's been massive changes in, you know, all sorts of atmospherics, and the planet adapts. It's us we're the ones that are potentially going to disappear, and we're so convinced that we're so important that we think our demise is somehow linked to the planet's demise,
yeah.
And I don't want to criticize. Yes, I do. Theistic religion, it seems to me, has a lot to do with this because it sets up a perception that there is a divine being who is, in fact, the father of kinds, and that makes all the rest of us children. And so we tend to operate in that ego state, in a child's ego state. We don't process this information as an adult. I think you're on the money as far as materialism being a major problem. And the thing about that is that the people who have most power in relation to that are the most destructive people. I think you're alluding to that. And there's not that many of them, but it's highly destructive. And my concern is, I think there are solutions. I know there are solutions. But I'm concerned about the time frame. So 10 years ago, I was saying, we've got 50 years to do something about this. And I was considered radical then. Now it's commonly agreed we've got 11 or 12 years to come up with something decisive. And it's going to have to be a global movement. And there are a lot of... And I'm not a climate scientist, I'm an ecologist. We do similar things. And there are a lot of ecologists and climate scientists that believe that we've actually gone beyond the tipping point. And what non-ecologists possibly don't understand is that ecosystems don't degrade in a gradual way. They degrade to a point and then they go cataclysmic, they go vertical. And I've watched 2 ecosystems in this state do that.
Yeah.
And those ecosystems are gone forever, essentially. What was I going to say about that? There are ecosystems all around the world that are in a state of collapse.
So part I think in your writing, one of your questions around was about how do we speak about this issue that no one wants to speak about, right?
Yeah. And I learned something from advertising, of all things.
Yeah.
And that is, if you want to sell something, don't try and sell it by expressing facts.
Yeah.
People are not interested in facts.
Yeah.
If you want to sell something, use emotion.
Yeah.
So my position, I've given up arguing with people about climate change. I've given up being angry with deniers. Deniers are easy to deal with one-on-one. Did I put the...
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So what I do now is I've kind of shrugged my shoulders and gone, well, I've spent 35 years of my life trying to, you know, understand this problem, and it's got worse. So what I do now is because I have a fairly good knowledge of the West Australian marine ecosystem, which is beautiful and unique and complex and an absolute standout coastline in the world. That's not, you know, you often hear people talking about maximum biodiversity and all that. This coastline has it all.
Yes.
So I tell people about that with joy, and I can do that with detail, and I leave them with it. And then, because that's all I can do, you know. A technical solution is not going to arise in the next 10 or 11 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just want to just touch on a few things that Craig has said, and maybe point a little bit to where I think Buddhism actually has something to offer in terms of at least an understanding. Part of the problem with climate change is that it's hard to imagine, and it's always pictured as something that happens in the distance. And it's not very close to us, so for that reason, we can't actually conceptualize it. Now, the thing about meditation training, and certainly from my experience, is that it gets you to notice things about how you think and how you feel, and you begin to understand a little bit about how your mind works. And you begin to see how you're actually conditioned in a number of ways by how you've been brought up, and you notice in some of your behavior some of that conditioning. I think you get to notice something about the conditioning based on your culture. You begin to go, oh, that's really interesting. I think this particular sort of way, but other cultures think a little bit differently. I think the harder thing to notice, actually, is the way we're conditioned as a human being. And human beings have a very funny set of conditioning experiences from just evolution. As through evolution, the way our brain is wired in a very particular sort of way that has nothing to do with what's true, what's real, what's important. So human beings are much more happy to deal with the immediacy of a threat than a long-term threat. That's how we're wired, because if you're a herd animal running around somewhere, you're focused on the fact that that tiger is going to eat you, not about some future event that's going to happen. So it's wired in your DNA, in your evolution, that you focus on the immediate threat and not a distant threat. Unfortunately, climate change is a distant threat. You tend to focus, because you're part of a herd, the periphery of the herd, and you're in the middle of the herd, you're just focusing what's in front of you. The herd, the periphery of the herd, has to sort itself out. So you're not that concerned about a threat to the periphery of the herd, because that's their business. And evolutionary-wise, we're designed to do that. We're designed to focus on what's in front of us, not so much further away. So if some Pacific island is drowning, that sort of like doesn't quite register. It registers at one level, but in an emotional sort of way, evolutionary-wise, it's a bit distant. We tend to discount it. There's a whole number of discountings that we do based on our DNA, based on how we've evolved, on how we're wired, right? We tend to focus on staying doing the same thing. It's like, that's the pattern, that's the routine, you default to this thing. And even though you might be heading towards a cliff, there's a funny way where you'll just keep staying on that same line rather than thinking about jumping off, because it takes a little bit of effort to jump off that habit, because habits are designed to make things simple for you. You fall into them, you do them, it rolls it out. There's an efficiency within habits. So when you put that all together, you begin to understand why climate change would be really tricky, because it's really distant. When you're in Australia, that's reasonably wealthy and not some Pacific island, and maybe not an immediate threat, you're going, well, it's just a bit far away. It's something to do with them, and you could discount that. It requires a big change about what we do, and you're going, well, let's keep on doing the same. So it's tricky. it's a little bit tricky. So we're stuck in a certain way of thinking and being, and again, that's our default. That's not right view, okay? that's a view that's clearly limited. And if we want some idea of a right view, and I would use another word, I'd go a bigger view, a more total view, a more correct perspective, again, I think we have to push out how we see ourselves in the world, because we will naturally just default back to this really narrow perspective based on evolution. Well, that's what we do. As human beings, we default back to everyday routine, run it through, don't worry about what's happening, just focus on what's immediate. So we have to keep challenging that. If we want right view and not default to a weird habit and the constraints of our evolution, we really need a practice to keep rethinking what is the reality. And again, the reality is we live on one planet. It's the only place where life is known to exist. We're completely dependent on it and the vast ecology, and dependent on other people. We have to keep on training ourselves to do that, as we train with all other practices in Dharma. The sitting practice is a training. The reflections on you know, whether it's the Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path, that's all training. We embed that sort of training to orientate ourselves to right view. This is just part of right view, a bigger, more total view, and we have to train it. We keep on having to train it that we can start acting from that place, because after right view, then you can have right intent, and then you can have right action, then you can have right speech, then you can have right livelihood. They follow from each other in a meaningful sort of way, and to my mind, this greater ecology speaks completely to Buddhism, because guess what? It's all about relationships. It's all about the fact there's no independent self. It's all about the fact it's all interrelated. It's all about impermanence. It's always forever changing. It's a whole teaching, if we can embed and immerse ourselves in that, that we can understand impermanence, that we can understand interdependence, that we can understand no self in a bigger, in a different sort of way. It's not traditional, it's not particularly classical, but it still is the same fundamental truths. So we're on about the truths that we're trying to understand in Buddhism. It speaks to the same truth. And it requires us as contemporary people, because as you notice, when Buddhism moves through different cultures, each culture adopts different practices to come to those understandings of different truths. It might involve us actually thinking a little bit more about what should be our practices as contemporary people that have to live in a world that are not monastics. What might that practice be? And this might be part and parcel of that practice. And how we engage in the world with that thought might be part and parcel of that practice. So there's, I think, a lot to be learned from that, and there's a lot of strength to gain from that. You know, one of the things that that I think Buddhism brings or can bring to the environmental movement, because as you encountered, it's despairing, it's fear-evoking, it makes you angry. But you can flip that around, actually, in a weird sort of way. You can flip all that around. You can flip it around by just simply understanding it's a gift. This notion of living in this one planet where the only place where life exists, and you have the good fortune to be here, is an incredible gift. It's an incredible miracle. So each day is a miracle if you can hang on to it in some way. You know, that's living a life out of some deep love for this life that you live. So that's not despair, that's just gratitude for the existence that you actually have. Right? And if you can move through life with that gift, acknowledging that you can't control the future, it's beyond us, you know, karma's vast, it depends on the interactions of a whole number of other people, not just us, right? But you can do your little bit, you're not completely in control, but in some way you can contribute. And if there is something about spirituality, it's funny. You ever looked up the definition of spirituality? It's really hard to find a definition. But behind it is some notion around meaning. Behind it is some notion usually about something more than yourself. So usually when you look up definitions, it speaks of something beyond the material world that speaks to a higher, a bigger sense of life that carries with it meaning, that gives meaning to a life. I would say that if you can embed yourself in this truth of the miracle of this life that you actually live, that's completely interdependent, that evokes a strong sense of a spirituality that's very deep and profound and can hold you and sustain you in the work that you do, that can start reshaping the direction of this current trajectory that we're heading, that's blindly going down some abyss with the idea somehow that having more and more and consuming more and more is somehow going to make us happier. Does anyone have any comments or questions? More questions?
Can I just raise the psychological? You mentioned the existentialist threat and the intensity of it. So initially I thought this problem was a technical and political one, that we would identify the problem and then politics would create change. Well, that's proved not to be true.
No, it's true, yeah.
At all. So I cast around thinking, why isn't this changing? And it occurred to me that it might have something to do with, like I said before, theistic religions, but also psychology. And the intensity of the existentialist threat, it seems to me, is so massive that we go into I think it's a classic medical, the limbic, we go to the, it's such a fear, we go straight to the limbic system, which is freeze, flight, or fight.
Yeah.
And what we've done is we've frozen, because it's that big, that, we perceive the issue to be that big, and that's happening for a lot of people at a subconscious level. And yeah. I think that needs to be raised up.
Yeah, but I think you can try to break it down. So the other thing about being a human being that's really wonderful is you can imagine. Not many other animals can actually imagine. So you have capacity to actually imagine the future. You can imagine a possibility. And unfortunately, because we're sort of a bit negatively biased, we tend to imagine the worst. But it's possible to imagine something better. We can train ourselves to actually imagine what's possible. And we can cooperate. So as human beings, we can cooperate in a way that most other animals can't. So the idea might be, rather than being frozen, if you can offer people a perspective, a way of taking action, of imagining something that's possible, imagining something that's local, imagining around a community rather than self. Imagine how you can come together in a meaningful sort of way to build something positive. I think all those things are narratives that are really worthwhile keeping going. I think it's that's another way. Break it down. Don't make it so big. Don't make it so threatening. See the advantage in numbers and building of that sense of community, not doing it on your own like that. Focus on the positives and what can be done. That's really an important idea. Now, there must be more questions, surely. There must be people out there. Yes.
I'm just wondering why environmentalists and spiritual leaders don't bring up the animal agriculture industry, its influence on the global environment.
Yeah.
Why not just start with that? Is that not the simplest, most obvious place to start?
They actually do. Actually, there's quite a concern around a whole number of issues around methane production, for example, in cattle and other ruminants, about how land is being treated, about deforestation. And so all those issues are live. They're certainly prominent. Recently, there's been paper from a health paper discussing sustainable food and agriculture in terms of both health and well-being and what's good for the climate. So those discussions are definitely alive and well. It's not that it's being excluded. I don't know why the media doesn't focus on it. It's not for the lack of actual output from scientific communities trying to outline that issue. It's probably more an uptake of the lobbying as to who's pushing it out there into the newspapers. Sometimes it gets a little bit controversial to do with farmers and the fact that some farmers, there's a whole farming community trying to do the right thing, trying to move things in the right direction, and they're wedged between other parts of their own community that are stuck in more conservative ways and how we might assist them in trying to move the agenda forward without putting them offside. Because it really is important that we keep everyone together on this journey, because there's a real fear about polarizing. So for me, there's a real, if we start polarizing this debate about who's right and who's wrong, who's at fault and who's not, and already we've seen polarized politics throughout the whole of the world, and anger and righteousness and the division and deep division that it causes, there's a way that we need to articulate these arguments that's beyond division, that's beyond righteousness, that tries to bring everyone on board, that tries to understand the other person's perspective and bring everyone on side in a way. I think they're really important things. They're really important ideas, because division divides us. Division creates conflict, and that's not the way we want to go. That's not good. So, yeah, it's out there, it's live. There's probably a number of reasons why it doesn't have the prominence compared to other issues, but it's definitely a live debate. Was there any other comments or questions? Yep.
I don't have any specific question, maybe a comment. Climate change is definitely a very big problem, but it's not a national problem. It's not an Australian national problem. It's very much a global problem, and that might be a good thing, because suddenly the whole planet Earth citizens has a problem which is common, and we all have to solve it.
Yes.
So that is an opportunity.
Yeah.
Might be the answer, or a start is just to build systems that beyond a national level, like that go cross-country, cross-culture, cross-religion.
Yeah.
And try to solve this issue.
There are
a few things that works heavily against us. One is that the population of planet Earth is increasing dramatically, and also life expectancy is increasing dramatically, and therefore the environmental footprint is getting higher. Another thing is any other systems, economical system that we try to implement before, which are not capitalism, well, they did not succeed so far. So the only thing that we do have is creating economical growth and creating jobs. And again, creating jobs that creating more products that pollute.
So, I think the crisis opens the door for incredible opportunity, because it's a global threat that means everyone has to come together in some way, and all of us are actually both completely. Many of us that are engaged in this sort of work are both really excited by the possibility.
Yeah, it might be a possibility.
Completely overwhelmed.
Might be a possibility is to leave planet Earth.
There's a whole number of things. I mean, if you look about what's possible, if I look back and I think to myself 40 years ago, and whether I could have conceptualized the Earth as it is now 40 years ago, it would have been beyond me to conceptualize this reality that we live in completely. Even if I tried to conceptualize from 20 years ago, like that's before phones, before, you know, the internet and everything else like that, could I have conceptualized what we can do now then? It would have been impossible for me to conceptualize. So, you know, the fact that this, that what we're trying to attain is beyond conceptualization, beyond our current capacity to imagine, doesn't mean it's not possible. So let's not constrain ourselves about what it is we can or can't do, because it's open-ended as far as I can see. It's completely open-ended. And I have amazing admiration for the ingenuity of human beings as to what they can do, especially when they come together. Is it about time, Anoush? Have we done time? Was there any other burning question?
Something you said has triggered a thought for me. So you talked about fight or flight. So when things are in our periphery, you know, close to us, that kind of we're wired for fight or flight. When things are more distant, you know, we're a bit more blasé about it. Doesn't really trigger that wired response. So your response to that was to try to have right view, so try to get a wider perspective, which is going to be hard, right? Because it's not how we're wired.
No, correct.
So it made me think about a blog I'd read a couple of weeks ago of somebody that went to visit some Japanese companies to see some lean manufacturing. And they talk about Kaizen, which is continuous improvement. And the for illustration purposes, they showed that if you put a glass of water in the middle of a table, there's kind of no pressure. Like, for example, a company's doing really well. There's no necessary drive to do Kaizen, continuous improvement. So as for illustration, they put the glass of water right on the side of the table where it's balanced, that it's about to fall off.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden now there's tension.
Yes.
And there's a desire to chase continuous improvement, small improvements, because you feel that tension.
Yes.
So it just made me start to think, how else could you do it other than right view? How could you create that tension that you tap into the natural wiring of a fight or flight?
Can't answer that one. I have to think long and hard. Don't know, yeah. We done, Anoush? One more, was there one more? No.
I think that's it, okay. Thank you. thank you very much. So if anyone has any questions, I'm sure maybe Richard can hang around for a bit, like person questions. But also, to keep the momentum going, there is a group that meet here, Buddhists for the Environment. Their details are on the notice board just outside. I'm not actually sure what they do. Maybe you know, because...
Not entirely sure either.
Okay. But one of the... Annie, who Richard knows, who's a member here, and she was an ex-nun, she's part of that group. So, yeah, I'm sure they're doing some good things.
Good one.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much, and have a good night, everyone.
Great. Thank you for having me. Cheers.